Everybody turn off your cell phones now, or at least put them in mute. We do record these events now. In fact, we put them up on our website, and it's a nuisance for everybody if they're trying to figure out what exactly was said and somebody's cell phone was going off. So if everybody checks them now, don't be embarrassed to check it now, but do be embarrassed if it makes a noise later. Second of all, I'd like to tell you about our events coming up this week. Tonight, actually, is the 100th birthday of Claire Hollingsworth, one of our most famous members. She was there in 1939. Happy birthday, Claire Hollingsworth. As many of you know, she was the one who had the scoop that the Germans were crossing the Polish border in 1939 for the Daily Telegraph. And she's still an active club member at 100. And so that party will be at 6 o'clock. It's our annual birthday party for Claire. It's a particularly important one since it's her 100th today. Then coming up on Wednesday, we have a documentary on the role of Asian artists in contributing to contemporary American art. That will be a dinner on Wednesday evening. You can sign up for it at the front desk. And then on Thursday at lunch, we have Hugo Dixon. He's the editor of the Reuters Breaking Views column. And again, you can sign up at the front desk. With that, I'd like to introduce our guest for today, Tom Orlick. Has a very distinguished background working at the British Treasury, working as an advisor for the IMF, working at Stone and McCarthy, telling investors what to make of Chinese economic statistics. He's now with the Wall Street Journal, working on the herd on the street column. And he's also the author of the book, which you have a chance to buy coming in or out, and for him to sign right here at the entrance. And with that, I give you Tom. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Keith. Very pleased to be here today, and huge thanks to the Foreign Correspondents Club for inviting me along to speak. I think it's a time of huge uncertainty for the Chinese economy and for the financial markets, and I hope that having such a large turnout for a lunchtime talk on statistics isn't a leading indicator of further troubles to come. But I think the fact that we have got such a huge turnout here today is a sign that China's economy is growing in importance. And it's very clear that if you want to understand developments in equity markets, in commodity markets, in currencies, it's increasingly important to understand what's going on in the Chinese economy. The lens through which everyone understands what's going on in China is China's economic data. But there's also huge uncertainty about what that data means, whether it can be trusted. I think when people think about the production of economic data in Hong Kong or the United States, they think about a group of careful PhD statisticians and economists poring over their spreadsheets, checking each decimal point is in the right place. When they think about the production of economic data in China, they think about a couple of drunken Communist Party officials singing karaoke, knocking back some baijiu, and picking the number which best fits with their own political needs. And 50 years ago, even 15 years ago, those fears about political manipulation of China's data were really not so far from the truth. So to get a lens on some of the problems with China's data system, I just want to spend a couple of minutes talking about two historical examples. Firstly, going back in time 50 years to the Great Leap Forwards. The Great Leap Forwards was Chairman Mao's disastrous attempt to move a backward agricultural economy to being a modern industrial economy in a few short years. And the way he wanted to achieve that was through the production of an agricultural surplus. He wanted a massive increase in grain output, which could then be sold, and that money could be used to invest in a modern industrial infrastructure. And what that translated to was extremely testing targets for towns and villages around the country to increase their production of grain. Unfortunately, this coincided with a very difficult year for China, very bad weather. But the pressure on local leaders to increase grain output was such that when they were asked how much output they produced, they engaged in rampant falsification of data. The leaders then had a very misleading impression of how much grain had been produced. The taxes that were levied were too high. There wasn't enough grain for people to eat. And so the failure of the statistical system, the failure of the leaders to provide accurate data on how much grain had been produced, contributed to what was history's greatest man-made famine. Now, a huge amount has changed in China in the last 50 years, but that fundamental conflict of interest, where local leaders are responsible for producing data on output, and they're also judged on that data, has been very slow to be resolved. So at the end of the 1990s, in the Asian financial crisis, we see a very similar problem. Asian financial crisis, we had China's neighbors sliding into crisis, China's own data on electricity output, on imports, on production of key goods like cement and steel, suggests that growth was extremely slow. Independent economists who look at the data have concluded that growth in 1998 was actually zero. But if you look at the data from China's National Bureau of Statistics, they're still reporting growth close to 8%. And what's happened is actually very similar to what happened in the Great Leap Forwards. Local leaders saw the reality of extremely slow growth. They knew the dream of career progression, which was based on growth hitting, testing 8% targets. And they engaged in another round of data falsification. Premier Zhu Rongyi spoke of a wave of embellishment and falsification sweeping through China's statistical system. And that kind of exaggeration and embellishment is really no good for anybody. It's no good for China's leaders because they don't have good information which they can use to make decisions about what's going on in the economy. It's also no good for the long-term health of the... It's no good for investor confidence in the Chinese growth story. As we've seen from what happened to small-cap stocks like Sinoforest, if investors lose confidence in the data, then they lose confidence in the company. If that happened on a grand scale for the entire Chinese economy, the consequences could be disastrous. So it's really not in China's leaders' interests to have inaccurate data. And what we've seen in the last 15 years, following from the problems with the Asian financial crisis, is a significant move to improve China's data collection system. Fundamentally, what's happened is that control of data production has been centralized. It's now the National Bureau of Statistics in Beijing that has direct responsibility for collecting data on all of the key indicators, from industrial output to the consumer price index to household income. So in 1998, they were still reliant on this dodgy local data. In 2010, what they're doing is they're collecting that data directly. They've taken the meddling local politicians out of the equation, and that means that China's national level data is now much more reliable. When people think about China's economic data, one of the problems which they often point to is that a mismatch between the sum of provincial GDP and national GDP. If you add up the GDP of all the different provinces in China, you always get a number which is significantly higher than the national total. A colleague of mine pointed out to me that the discrepancy is actually as large as the entire GDP of Switzerland. So shame on Switzerland for having a GDP only as large as a statistical discrepancy in China. Now, my view on this is that there is a problem, but the problem's at a provincial level. And if you look at the chart here, what the green lines are showing you is the difference between the sum of provincial GDP and national GDP. And what they show you is that gap starts to emerge in 1997, 1998, at the same time as the Asian financial crisis underlines the problems with local data. So the difference between the provincial data and the national data shows there's a problem at a provincial level, but it also shows the government has taken steps to free the national data from the impact of this local exaggeration. So there's been significant improvements, but there are also huge problems that remain. Rather than talking about those in the abstract, what I'm going to do is just spend a few minutes rattling through the last 3 years in China's economy and use that to illustrate some of the problems and some of the strengths in China's economic data. So in 2009, the world economy is once again sliding into crisis, and there's widespread concern that the National Bureau of Statistics is going to come under pressure to cook the books. Everyone thinks, well, if China's economy really does hit the rocks, the National Bureau of Statistics will come under massive pressure to say that growth has still hit the 8% target. my view is that China's GDP data in 2009 does tell the story of what happened, but it tells it in a way which is slightly misleading. And the reason for that is that China reports its GDP data on a year-on-year basis. Most other countries in the world, US, Hong Kong, report data on a quarter-on-quarter annualized basis. And those two approaches are very different. And to illustrate how different they are, I'm going to use the example of my daughter Josephine, whose pictures you can see here. So let's imagine that these are quarterly pictures of Josephine. And the first one was taken in the first quarter of 2008, and the last one was taken in the first quarter of 2009. Let's imagine we've taken Josephine to the doctor in the first quarter of 2009, and the doctor says, "Congratulations, on a year-on-year basis, your baby continues to grow." I think those of you who are parents will know that that is not the most significant thing which has happened to Josephine in the first quarter of 2009. The most significant thing is that she's shrunk from the first quarter of from the fourth quarter of 2008. So on a year-on-year basis, she's healthy. On a quarter-on-quarter basis, there's a really serious problem. And if the doctor doesn't recognize it, we probably have to maybe pay for a different hospital. Something very similar is happening with China's GDP data. On a year-on-year basis, the data shows a very mild recovery, a very mild slowdown in the first quarter of 2009. National Bureau of Statistics is saying the economy has grown 6% from the first quarter of 2008, and that's true, but the most significant thing which has happened is that on a quarter-on-quarter basis, growth has collapsed. The People's Bank of China were so frustrated with the National Bureau of Statistics and their inability to produce quarter-on-quarter data that they started putting out their own series, which you can see in this chart. And as you can see from the red line, at the end of 2008 and in the first quarter of 2009, growth in Chinese economy really collapsed. GDP is an area where China's kind of worked hard to make improvements in the data. They now actually do publish a quarter-on-quarter data point. One of the areas where there's been very few improvements in China's economic data is in labor markets. So if you look at unemployment data for China for the last decade, through the closure of the state-owned enterprises, the entry into WTO, the boom years that followed, and then the financial crisis, unemployment is basically completely unchanged at around 4%. And if you follow developments in China's economy, you'll know that that number is completely incredible. In the first half of 2009, factories up and down the East Coast were closing. Migrant workers were going back to the farms. Unemployment was surging. That was not captured in the official data. But happily, the official data is not the only data point that you have to rely on when you're looking at China's labor markets. The Ministry of Human Resources and Social Security also publishes a very sensitive indicator of what's happening in China's labor markets. What they do is something very simple. Every quarter, they add up the number of people going into local employment offices looking for a job, and the number of employers going into local labor offices looking for employees. They also publish the ratio of those two numbers. And that ratio is actually a very sensitive indicator of what's happening in China's labor markets. And it's a very useful tool for understanding what's going to happen to Chinese wages and Chinese inflation. So if you look at the red line in this graph, you can see that at the end of 2008 and in the first part of 2009, there's actually a very sharp increase in the number of people looking for jobs. Unemployment does increase sharply, and that makes a lot of sense when you think about what's happened to the export sector. What it also shows is that China's stimulus is extremely effective. So by the first half of 2010, you've actually had a historic change in China's labor markets. For the first time in China's reform era history, you have more job opportunities than you have job seekers. And that's actually a hugely significant change. So for all of the years up until the financial crisis, there's more job seekers than there are opportunities. And that means that power in China's labor markets is really in the hands of employers. They're the ones who can dictate wages. And that's why China's wages have stayed very low, China's exports have been so competitive, and China's government has not really faced a problem with inflation. What this labor market data is now saying is that there's more job opportunities than there are job seekers. So the power in labour markets has shifted into the hands of workers. That's why in the first half of 2010, we heard all of these stories about strikes. That's why we heard all these stories about double-digit increases in the minimum wage. And that's why going forwards, you can expect higher wages to dent the competitiveness of China's export sector and cause a bigger problem for the government in terms of inflation. So by 2010, it really seems like the economy is getting back onto an even keel, and the government starts to talk about withdrawing the stimulus. China's stimulus came mainly through an increase in bank lending. In 2009, there was a massive increase in bank loans. China's banks put 9.5 trillion yuan in new loans out of the door. If you continued to watch the new loan data, you'd be forgiven for thinking that China was actually strictly withdrawing the stimulus. In 2010, new loans fell to 7.5 trillion yuan, 2 trillion less. In fact, what was happening is that China's banks were very reluctant to stop lending. Lending is how they make money. When the government told them to stop, they found sneaky ways to evade the government's controls. But the data didn't keep up with that. So if you looked at the new lending data, you thought that the stimulus was being withdrawn. If you realized that the banks were doing something different, they were making these off-balance sheet loans, then you recognized that actually China's monetary stimulus stayed in place all the way through 2010. The People's Bank of China has now recognized this problem, and they've come out with a new data series called Total Social Finance, a measure which includes bank lending, trust loans, and other types of credit. And what that shows, as you can see from the top graph, is that whilst new loans from the banks fell sharply, total social finance stayed constant at 14 trillion. The monetary stimulus was not withdrawn in 2010. The second policy tool which the government said they were using to rein in the stimulus in 2010 was the exchange rate. In June 2010, with much fanfare, the People's Bank of China says, we're ending the yuan's peg to the dollar. Now, for the last year, if you've been watching the yuan-dollar exchange rate, it really seems like the yuan's been appreciating somewhat strongly. It's risen more than 6% against the dollar. That should be a way of taking some of the heat out of China's economy. But in fact, looking at the yuan-dollar exchange rate is not the best way of understanding China's exchange rate policy. And that's for two reasons. Firstly, most of China's trade is not with the United States. If you want to understand the real impact of the exchange rate on competitiveness, you have to look at the trade-weighted exchange rate. And on a trade-weighted basis, the yuan has not moved at all since June 2010. The second reason is that the exchange rate is only one factor dictating the competitiveness of China's exports. China's exporters are very smart. They're finding ways to be more productive, to do more with less. And that enables them to make savings which offset the appreciation of the yuan. You can see this very strikingly in the second chart. So you can see from the blue line, the yuan has risen more than 30% or around 30% against the dollar from 2005 till now. But the cost which US consumers face from imports from China has only increased 3%. So almost the entire impact of yuan appreciation has been absorbed by China's exporters through improvements in productivity. So 2010, the government talks about withdrawing the stimulus, but actually in terms of total amount of credit, in terms of the exchange rate, the stimulus is staying pretty firmly in place. And the consequence of that is inflation. China's government likes to talk about inflation in terms of supply side shocks to the agricultural sector. There's always a disease in the pig population, or a drought, or a flood, or something which is affecting food supply, which is dictating developments in the consumer price index. I think already this year we've had the worst flood in 50 years and the worst drought in 50 years. So it never rains but it pours for China's agricultural sector. In fact, I think there's something much more simple at work dictating inflation dynamics in China, and that's the money supply. Money supply increased massively in 2009 and 2010. The consequence of that is that we see very high inflation in 2011. Inflation is one of these areas where there's enormous doubts about the reliability of China's data. There was a newspaper article which was headlined, "Do Statisticians Buy Groceries?" And the sort of the sarcastic sort of reading between the lines point is that if they did buy groceries, they would be ashamed to publish inflation data which was so mismatched with the reality of rapid increases in prices. My view is that the consumer price index is not the victim of political manipulation. The statisticians are not adding up the change in prices, finding that they've increased 10%, but then announcing a 5% increase for political reasons. The problem is that the way in which inflation is measured in China doesn't capture some important aspects of consumers' lives. And you can see that very clearly from this second chart. Second chart shows the consumer price index against a measure from the People's Bank of China of household satisfaction with price levels. And what you can see is that although the CPI, which is the blue line, moves up and down, household satisfaction with prices continues to fall. And what that tells you is that the consumer price index is missing something really important about Chinese households' experience of inflation. And I think the thing which it's missing is house prices. House prices are not well reflected in the CPI, and even the government's direct measure of house prices is really one of the most problematic data points in the Chinese economy. In 2009, the National Bureau of Statistics announced that house prices had increased 1.5% for the year. And this was so massively at odds with the experience of people on the street trying to buy a home that there was an outcry on the internet. One commentator asked if the National Bureau of Statistics had misplaced the decimal point. If you live in China and you look at what's happening to house prices, it's fairly clear that they've been increasing quite sharply. And there is a much more compelling story told about what's happening to China's house prices by a private data provider called Sofen. So what the Sofen data shows is actually extremely sharp increases in house prices. If you look at the official data for Shanghai, it shows that house prices in Shanghai have increased maybe 20% in the last 5 years. If you look at the Sofen data, what it shows is that prices in Shanghai have increased 260% in the last 5 years. So a massive discrepancy. And this discrepancy is not just of academic interest, it also has enormous implications for how China's economy develops. And that's because the real estate sector is such a huge part of China's economy. Real estate investment accounts directly for 15% of China's GDP. If you start adding in demand for steel and cement and other construction materials, you get to a number closer to 20% of GDP. So a hard landing for China's real estate sector would really be a disaster for the economy. Now, at the same time, because the government has recognized prices are high, they've taken these steps to cool the sector off. So if you believe the official price series, prices have only risen 20% in the last 5 years, the problem faced by the government in controlling the property bubble is really very simple. Prices haven't risen very much, so they don't have to fall very much. The government can keep its controls on the sector in place for a short period, and then it can remove them. So the risks of a hard landing for the Chinese real estate sector are pretty small. But if you believe the Sofen data that house prices have actually risen extremely sharply, are substantially misaligned with income, then the Chinese government has to keep its controls on the property sector in line for a much longer period of time, and that raises the chances of a hard landing for the property sector and for the Chinese economy. So lots of the things which I've spoken about so far are about how things are actually worse than the data suggests. GDP is more volatile than you think, unemployment is higher than you think, house prices are higher than you think. But actually, not all of the problems with the real estate, with problems with China's economic data, mean that the real situation is worse than you think. So one example of this is in China's household income data and the way that plays into the debate on China's economic imbalances. So if you live in, I live in Beijing, I cycle to work, and I regularly narrowly avoid collisions with Bentleys, Rolls Royces, Mercedes. And the people who drive these cars, they're not earning 40,000 yuan a year. But if you look at the National Bureau of Statistics data, the National Bureau of Statistics believes that China's top 10% have a disposable income of 40,000 yuan a year. you can't afford a Bentley on 40,000 yuan a year. I maybe couldn't even afford my bicycle on 40,000 yuan a year. There's something wrong with this data point. And the problem is really that people in China are not willing to share the full truth with the officials or the statisticians. China's rich are earning a large percentage of their income from kickbacks, from bribes, from other sources that they're not really willing to share with the authorities. And so that means the official data on incomes massively understates the reality. A professor called Wang Xiaolu did his own survey in 2008, and he found that income for China's top 10% is actually three times higher than the official total suggests. Now, one of the main concerns about China's economy is this imbalance towards business and investment and away from households and consumption. So in one way, if China's rich are actually much richer than you think, that's a bad thing, right? Because it means the divide between the haves and the have-nots is greater. But from the point of view of China's imbalances, if household income is actually substantially higher than you think it is, then perhaps we don't have to be so worried about these imbalances in the Chinese economy. Perhaps China's households are not doing quite as badly as the official data suggests. So, summing up, I think China's data is massively important. Equity markets, not just in Shanghai and in Hong Kong, but also increasingly in London and New York. Prices for commodities, from copper to soybeans. Currencies, from the Australian dollar to the euro and the US dollar, are moved by developments in China. Understanding what's going on means getting to grips with what's going on in China's economic data. I think the worst fears of political manipulation of the data are misplaced. But the numbers still need to be taken with a grain of salt. Technical weaknesses are extremely widespread. Sample sets are outdated. Chinese people lie to the statisticians. The solution, I think, is to be a smart consumer of the data, to understand where it's coming from and what it means. And that's what I try and help people do with my book. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that very informative speech. And with that, I'd like to throw open the floor for questions. Who would like to ask the first question? Please identify yourselves. Thank you.
Daniel Hui, Barrister, Hong Kong. Sorry to put you on the spot. I'm trying to make this question very simple, but difficult at the same time. Are the official stats now coming out of the PRC uncontaminated by political commissars meddling?
Okay, so here's what I think is going on. I think that for the big numbers on things like GDP and CPI, there aren't political commissars meddling with the data. But there are areas which are politically sensitive, like unemployment or house prices. And the solution there is not to calculate the data and then to have the politicians come in and change the total. The solution is really kind of benign neglect. So for unemployment, they basically just don't bother. So they still publish a number, but it's based on an extremely old sample set, which has very little relationship with what's going on in labor markets. And that's kind of convenient for them because it shows unemployment very low and stable. So it's not Premier Wen Jiabao coming in and saying, you can't publish that number, you must publish a lower number. It's really just a policy of benign neglect and allowing a sort of outdated approach to calculating the data to stay in place.
How do you come up with a sample set, though, that shows unemployment always between 4 and 4.1%?
Well, I think the issue is that in order to be in the unemployment data, you need to claim unemployment benefit. And the people who are the main sort of area where there's fluctuations in China's labor markets are the migrant workers, right? So the migrant workers, they leave Anhui and they go to Guangdong to work in a factory. And that factory closes. But they're not entitled to unemployment benefits in Guangdong. So they didn't show up in the Guangdong unemployment data. And when they go back to Anhui, they're from a village, which doesn't have unemployment benefits. They go back to their farm, and they stay there raising corn until the economy is picked up. So they're not really captured in either of the provinces where they live or they work.
Do they even capture private enterprises in cities laying off people, or it's mostly state-owned enterprises laying off people that would be
captured?
Well,
if you were entitled to unemployment benefits, and you, the other thing to say is unemployment benefits are extremely low, so even if you were entitled to them, it maybe doesn't make that much sense for you to go and go through the bureaucratic process in order to claim them. So either you're not entitled to them because you're not in the right province, or there's no point in you claiming them because they're not worth that much money. But for one reason or another, it's not worth your while to go and fill in the paperwork, and that's great for the government because you don't show up in the data.
And just and on the housing prices, can you talk a little bit about, you mentioned how the 1.5% for 2009
right,
was
right.
ridiculed, but what is the data set for that? Is it one specific kind of housing in each city, maybe low-income housing?
So I think the problem is, there are two problems. Firstly, there's discretion for local officials to define the sample for house prices in their area, and they know that it's not, their leaders are not going to welcome a very high number for house price increases. It's a very sensitive subject. So they just focus their attention on older housing stock where changes in prices are lower, and they define the borders of the city very, very widely. So they would include kind of suburbs and villages, which you wouldn't really think about if you were thinking about, you know, the core city area. And the result, by looking at old prices, by looking at older property, by looking at sort of distant suburbs, is that you miss the newer, higher-end property where the changes in prices are most marked. I should say that the National Bureau of Statistics promised, after the outcry in 2009, to do better. And in 2011, they rolled out a new system which abolished the national average house price data, which is one way of solving the problem.
Mike.
Mark Michelson from APCO. Thanks for that, Tom. You mentioned, you sort of alluded to what the government knows and what it doesn't know about statistics, and mentioned in terms of property that they might have taken that perhaps weren't as strong, but it's an important point, obviously. Is the government, obviously the government's aware of discrepancies. Do they have enough of a handle on key statistics to be able to develop policy? For example, during the global financial crisis, the policy measures they took suggested that they didn't believe the data that was coming out publicly, but they were far more worried, and therefore took, as you mentioned, longer lasting stimulus measures.
Right.
What is the situation? Because this could be worrying if they aren't getting the right numbers either.
Right, absolutely. I think that actually, if you look at, firstly, I think the Chinese government's economic policy is actually one of the sort of bright lights in the administration. Actually, it's you can say, okay, you kept tightening in place for a few months too long, or you loosened a bit too aggressively. But you know, looking at where the Chinese economy is now and where other economies are in the world, it's difficult to find too much fault with their management of the economy. And if you look at the way in which they behave and the times they make policy changes, it does appear that they're making decisions based on the official data. So, you know, it's pretty easy to call movements in interest rates based on looking at the CPI. When the CPI goes above 4 or above 5, that's out of the government's comfort zone, and you see some serious moves towards tightening. So I think they're looking at the official data and they're making decisions based on the official data. I think they're also aware where there's weaknesses in the data. We actually met with the chairman of SOFIN, the agency which collects private data on house prices, and he said that very senior Chinese leaders made their decisions on the housing market based on his data set rather than the official data set. I also think that National Bureau of Statistics is doing a lot of work which we don't see. They're doing a lot of on-the-ground surveys. For example, they're going and talking to exporters and they're finding out how much pain they're suffering from the appreciation of the yuan, and that is feeding into the government's decision-making process. Doesn't mean the official data is wrong. It means that they're getting a sort of richer data set which isn't available to the public.
Here, and then back here, and then up here.
Dan Ryan's my name. I'm a lawyer in Hong Kong. I guess that's a related question, but how good do you think they actually the government are at interpreting the data that it collects? And secondly, is it actually a good thing that China has an increasing number of data points about its economy? And I ask that because in Hong Kong, the legendary financial advisor John Copperthwaite was disparaging about collection of data by officials. His argument was that if you gave them these data points, they'd place too much confidence in it, would always be backward looking, and it would just give them an encouragement to do things, right, which wouldn't necessarily be, right, which would be a guess about what the future will be, and they had no real idea. The data gave them false confidence.
Okay. I think that there isn't a problem with people in the People's Bank of China, which is probably one of China's key economic policy institutions, understanding what the data means. They have a very sophisticated understanding of what's going on in the Chinese economy. If there's a problem with interpreting the data, it really lies in the different interest groups which are competing over control of China's economic policy, right? So in very simple terms, you've got inflation hawks at the People's Bank of China, and you've got kind of growth-focused politicians almost everywhere else in the government. So the problem is not that China's leaders are looking at the data and drawing the wrong conclusions. The problem is that lots of the people who have control over China's policy levers don't actually care that much if inflation is slightly too high. What they care about is whether there's going to be enough investment to keep GDP growth churning along. So I wouldn't see a problem with interpretation. I'd see a sort of a problem with who's controlling the policy process. On the question of whether or not there's too many data points, all of these indicators are backward-looking. They tell you what's happened in the Chinese economy last month or over the last quarter. They don't tell you what's happening going forwards. So if you place too much attention on them, you might miss important turning points, or you might be placing too much attention on the past. But again, I think that the people making decisions on monetary policy are pretty sophisticated, and they know that. So on balance, I would think that more data is better than less data.
Certainly. There's some more questions. We've got three more I can see right now. Well, a bunch more. Okay, over here though first, and then we've got one up here next.
I'm Toh Han Shi from the South China Morning Post. Recently, Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping told American Vice President Joe Biden that China will not have a hard landing but a soft landing. Then I asked an economist about it and says that, well, the Chinese government can just define what a hard or soft landing is, and then the China will have a soft landing. What are your comments on that?
Well, the Chinese government can define hard or soft landing, but people have a kind of lived experience of what's going on in the economy, right? They either have a job or they don't have a job. They're either seeing wages rise faster than inflation or lower than inflation. If you're in the financial markets, you're either seeing equity markets going up or going down. So I'm sure the Chinese government will do a very good job of trying to frame whatever's going on in positive terms. But the reality is that people's lived experience of their jobs and their employment and their wages and their investments is going to be much more important for them than whatever the Chinese government is saying about hard or soft landings.
Up here, or why don't we go over here now? Do you still have a question? Okay, we'll get you next then. I'm sorry. And wait over here, please. Whoops. Over here, please.
Hi, Abhik Bhattacharya, also with Wall Street Journal. I'm thinking
about.
It's
going to be an easy question if you're one of my colleagues.
I'm thinking about the consumption and investment slide that you had, I think right before this one. And I guess when I think about it, I'm just trying to think about which data set I should believe in. If we go along with what you're saying, then you're throwing into doubt this consensus that China has really high investment and really low consumption. But if I look at, say, current account data, and this is something that foreigners also vet and international institutions like the IMF also stand by, you just by economic theory see a massive, massive savings imbalance, very high savings, just because by definition, if the current account is so high, that means savings is so much higher than investment, which is by then so much higher than consumption.
Right.
So what should I then believe in? Should I be not looking at current account numbers when I'm trying to see what the savings, consumption, investment imbalances are? Should I be looking at some of the household data that you point out, which obviously then show the other way around.
Right. No, I think that's a great point. And in fact, one of the most reliable data series in China is the import and export data and by extension, the current account data. So I'm not denying that there's a serious problem with investment and excess investment in the Chinese economy. I think what I'm just trying to say is that there are data points which suggest that perhaps that households are not doing quite as badly as the data on income suggest. In fact, if you look at one of the other data series which is extremely unreliable in China is retail sales data. And one of the reasons it's unreliable is because if you spend any time in mainland China, you'll know that a vast amount of consumption takes place in the informal economy. So small businesses, small shops, hairdressers, they don't want to pay taxes. So they don't give you a fa piao, they don't give you a receipt, and they don't tell the tax man about the service or the sale they've made to you. And so that doesn't get reported. So retail sales figures are probably also understating the amount of consumption going on in the Chinese economy. So I think you're right that the current account data does show us that there's an imbalance toward investment. But I think these other data series suggest that perhaps consumption, household income are slightly more vibrant than the macro data suggests.
Up here, please.
Jane Singer from Inside Fashion. I just have a quick question. You had mentioned that the employment figures were probably not correct, but that focused specifically on the worker sector, blue-collar workers, which is true because there has been, a contraction in terms of the factories. Mm. But we had heard that in the white-collar area, that there was over 1 million graduates coming out of university where there were no jobs. Mm. Do you have any comment on employment in that sector?
It's not something I've looked at in detail recently. I did hear during the 2009 that the government was extremely worried about this problem with vast numbers of students leaving the universities and with nothing to do. And of course, China doesn't have a very good record of what happens when there are lots of students with nothing to do. So that was something the government was concerned about. I don't have a great answer for you,
okay.
But I would say that the data series I was mentioning, the labor market supply and demand balance data, it does break down job seekers by age and education. So
okay.
If you wanted to get a detailed view on whether young graduates were finding jobs or not, that data series would tell you that.
Okay, thank you.
Francis.
Yeah, Francis Moriarty, RTHK. I should preface this by saying I'm not a financial reporter, so this is all sort of Greek to me. So my questions are very simple. It seems to me, first of all, that in any collection of data on almost anything, if at some point you change the question, you invalidate all of the data that went before because you can't make comparisons anymore. And in China, if you make a change, you're considered to be accusing somebody else effectively of making a mistake, which is not something you can do. So I'm wondering, first of all, whether there's just two sets of books, and that whatever is out there publicly, you can either take or ignore, depending on whether it works for you, and assume that the government has an internal set of books. And if that's the case, I wonder where their data would come from, because either you're going to rely on the provinces for information and then try to squeeze the water out of it, or you're going to have a parallel system of collecting information for the government. So where do we stand when it comes to the simple question of what credibility or level of credibility can we give when we're looking at Chinese economic statistics?
Great question. I think that the first point you make, that when you change the way you measure something, you create problems with comparability with what's happened in the past, is extremely relevant for thinking about China's economic data. Firstly, as you mentioned, it creates a barrier to reform. People in the National Bureau of Statistics who've been collecting these data for 30 years, they don't want someone to come along and say, okay, you've been doing this wrong and we're changing it. So that is one of the reasons why it's more difficult to make progress. And when they do make progress, it does mean that it's difficult making backward-looking comparisons. So all of your main data series on China, industrial output, retail sales, fixed asset investment, CPI, PPI, they all changed their approach to measurement at the beginning of this year. in the main, they shifted the sample set from a bigger group of companies to a smaller group of companies to make it easier to collect the data. And that means that if you're looking at a comparison of industrial output this year against last year, that's kind of problematic because you're looking at a different set of data. Second question, is China keeping two sets of books? No, I don't think so. And I think the reason for that is that if China was keeping two sets of books, then you'd start to see the government making policy decisions which were really not explicable in terms of what was going on in the published data. And you're not seeing that. You'd also have a problem whereby the government makes policy decisions which are meant to affect business decisions. Now, if businesses are seeing a set of public data which is showing inflation moderate, and the government is seeing a set of data which shows inflation high, then you've got government and business and households making decisions based on two different sets of data. And that would really be a recipe for chaos. And my view is it's not something that's going on.
We are 6 minutes over our usual time. I apologize, I can see. Well, why don't we have one more from Phil to wrap it up here, and then we'll get all of you out of here quickly, but while giving you a chance, of course, to get a book on the way out. Phil?
You've told us about the rise in property prices, and you've also inferred a very large increase in the production of residential and other housing. At what point, how far do prices have to fall before we reach equilibrium?
That's a really interesting question, and if I knew the answer to that, I'd probably be an investor rather than a journalist. I mean, what is equilibrium property prices in an economy which is urbanizing, that's growing at 10% a year, and that has very few profitable investment vehicles other than real estate? All of these things suggest that if you've got any investment money to spare, you should put it into the real estate sector. Until those conditions change, I think that the chances of a very sharp correction in China's house prices are pretty unlikely. The other thing I would say on this is that the slowdown in China's property prices that we're seeing right now is really a function of policy. It's the government stepping in and saying, speculators, we're kicking you out of the market. So people are worried about a hard landing for China's property sector, and I worry about the chances of a policy misstep. But the important thing to realize is that the slowdown is a function of policy. And when that policy changes and the speculators come back in, even though prices are misaligned with income, it's quite likely that they continue to rise. So I'm afraid I kind of evaded giving a precise answer to your question, but I hope those elements are useful.
Thank you very much. We try to give our guests something to remember the club by. Thank you all for coming. Hope we'll see you at some more of our events this week.